Hello, and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas from courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. The idea of a podcast was conceived as a way to be able to present content that was developed for the 2020 Dispute Resolution Symposium. That conference was unfortunately called off due to that plan-crushing pandemic called COVID-19. We are using this podcast format so we don't lose that valuable content. Today's topic relates to what's known as the New Singapore Convention. It's the United Nations Convention on International Settlement Agreements resulting from mediation. By the end of the podcast, you will be able to understand the context of the Singapore Convention and recognize the possible implications of the convention in your domestic mediation practice. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 9. Our topic is the New Singapore Convention on Mediation. What does it mean for mediation in the U.S.? Joining me today, a marine biologist turned renowned legal scholar, is Professor Ellen Deason. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a delight.
Professor Deason, you have had a shockingly impressive legal career, but before we get to that, I want to talk about your interesting pre-legal background. You received a Master's of Science from Oregon State University of Oceanography. What kind of sea life did you study as a marine biologist?
Well, that seems a long time ago now, but I actually studied microscopic animals called zooplankton, which means animals that float around in the in lakes and oceans, and how they eat microscopic, even tinier microscopic plants called phytoplankton, which you could think of as really small algae. And I enjoyed working out as a graduate student in Oregon. I did some work in Alaska, and then I worked for a number of years at the University of Rhode Island and studied the relationships between these different levels of animals and plants in Narragansett Bay.
And I read one of those levels was jellyfish?
Yeah, they're a jelly animal. They're not jellyfish. They're called tenophores, and they eat the microscopic zooplankton, which then eat the plants. And so the relationships are very interesting. So I got to spend a lot of time on the water sampling, and then a lot of time at the microscope counting. The grant I was working on got cut, and I ended up doing some work in coastal zone management, and that led me to law school. So it was a transition I had never anticipated, but one that has shaped my life ever since.
From Tina Forest, did I say that right?
To swimming. Yes, you did. You did. Yeah.
I actually have a marine biology and law joke. Why don't sharks eat lawyers? Professional courtesy.
That's very good.
Thanks. Appreciate that. You received your Juris Doctorate from the University of Michigan College of Law, where you were editor-in-chief of the Law Review. And our listeners will be interested to learn this. You were a law clerk for the Honorable Harry A. Blackmun of the U.S. Supreme Court. And for those listeners who don't know, Blackmun was an associate justice appointed by President Richard Nixon, and he is best known as the author of the court's opinion in Roe v. Wade. So tell us, what was it like clerking for him?
Oh, it was a wonderful experience. He was just someone to admire. He took such great care in making the decisions and in writing the opinions. It was hard work. You couldn't do it for much more than a year. But he was working just as hard as we were, from 7 in the morning until late at night. And it just was such a thrill to be part of the process of trying to make the law be as good as it can be, and to make a little contribution there.
Now, do you remember working on any big cases? What was a case that you worked on that you thought was interesting?
I worked on one that was particularly interesting about discovery in international cases. And we wrote a concurring opinion. So that was a particularly satisfying case that wasn't perhaps the most high profile of the cases. There were so many, but it was also fun to be in the building with the law clerks for all the other justices, because you're in a situation where you have 9 law clerks who are completely immersed in an opinion. And so the conversations about the opinions were really valuable and stimulating.
I'll bet.
Even when we disagreed.
Yeah, of course. Then you served as a legal assistant to arbitrator Howard M. Holtzman at the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal. So that tribunal has to decide claims between United States and Iranian nationals and debts, contracts, everything that they're doing. What did you learn from that job?
Well, that was very interesting, and it was located in The Hague in the Netherlands. And so to live there for a year and work with lawyers from all around the world was fascinating. The cases I worked on were all cases by American citizens, and that could be corporations or people who had left Iran against the Iranian government. And all these claims came out of the Iranian Revolution. And actually, the tribunal is still going on. But I learned a lot about arbitration. That was an early application of international arbitration rules were created by UNCITRAL. And I learned a lot about what it was like to work with lawyers with a different legal perspective, because the Iranian lawyers just started from a whole different set of assumptions than we had. And if you accepted their assumptions, their arguments made sense. But if your starting place was different, it was very, you would not buy their results, let's put it that way. So it was quite interesting. And then a lot of the other lawyers were from other countries. So New Zealand and France and Denmark and Scandinavia, as well as the US.
What a fascinating job. If I had known that was a job, I might have looked into that after law school. That sounds amazing.
It was a fascinating job, and we came home the long way around the world and took some vacation.
Oh, of course. You are a prolific researcher and writer, and your article on appropriate roles for judges in settlement was selected by the Association of American Law Schools Section of Dispute Resolution as the best ADR article published in 2017. So yay for you. And you've recently written a new book. Can you tell us about your book, Global Issues in Mediation?
The book was written with 2 co-authors, Jackie Nolan Haley at Fordham University and Mariano Crespo Hernandez Gonstead at St. Thomas in Minneapolis. And it's an overview of all the issues in mediation that are global. I mainly worked on the parts about legal issues and also about joining up arbitration and mediation together, and which is a controversial topic. But we have examples of mediations from all sorts of different cultures and explore lots of different aspects. It's meant as a book that could be used as a text for teaching, but also to give anyone a basic foundation in international mediation, not just commercial, but also between countries.
Very good. And you are teaching as well, at a professor at The Ohio State University. So what do you like about teaching?
I love the students. The students are so engaging, and they keep me energetic, and it's just such a wonderful process to see them grow in the law and become real lawyers. I've taught civil procedure, and I've taught dispute resolution courses, and I love them all.
That's awesome. Be nice with that bell curve. I remember that was rough.
Yes. There are a lot of things I have no control over. And I'm afraid that the grading curve is unfortunately one of them.
All right. Well, are you all set to present on the new Singapore convention on a new podcast platform today?
Let's do it.
All right. Can you please start with an explanation of the convention? What kind of cases does this apply to? And can you just explain a little bit about conventions and how they work?
Well, convention is a fancy name really for a treaty. And so this is an international treaty with lots and lots, will eventually, we hope, have lots and lots of countries sign on to it. Right now, there are 53 countries that have signed it. It was opened for signature. In other words, the negotiations were finished and it was finalized a year and a half ago, August 2019. And currently 53 countries have signed it. That's the first step. The second step is the internal domestic process where the country ratifies it. And each country has different mechanisms for doing that. In the U.S., it has to be approved by the Senate. Right now, there are six countries that have gone through that second step and ratified. And so that was enough to put it, what they call entered into force. So it is an international treaty. And as of this past September 2020, it entered into force. It was negotiated at the UN and in Europe by an organization called UNCITRAL, which is a fancy way of, well, it's the abbreviation for United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. And they have created a number of conventions and also sets of rules and models for countries to use relating to international trade. And of course, part of trade and commercial transactions are going to be disputes. And so it's important to have ways to resolve them. So you asked about what the convention, and I should say, I was lucky enough to attend some of the negotiating meetings that were held at the UN in New York as an observer, an official observer from the American Society of International Law. And that was a great privilege to see all this in action. What we ended up with is a treaty that gives a mechanism for enforcing mediated settlement agreements. And they have to be mediated settlement agreements that come from an international dispute and from a dispute that was commercial. So very importantly, from the U.S. perspective, this excludes some controversial, some topics that would be controversial to be enforced. Consumer transactions are not included. And also employment and family and inheritance issues.
So that sweater I never got from ordering it off a Chinese website, it's not going to be covered?
No. Okay. And that's partly because we don't want to impose this on people like you who don't have a lot of resources and may not be available. I may not be aware of all that would go into it. Whereas commercial entities, you assume they have a lawyer, you assume that they have someone advising them about the consequences of entering into an agreement.
So how does the Singapore Convention help with the enforcement of mediation agreements?
Well, what it does is it takes what was a private contract between in the agreement to settle the dispute, you write a contract up, you write an agreement, and then that would, if there were problems enforcing it. Now, most of those agreements, people abide by them. But if someone decides they don't want to abide by it, then you have to be going to court somewhere and try to enforce a contract. Huge problems with that, because every country has different contract law, different procedures. And if you get an order from a court enforcing it, you may not be able to take that order where you need to get your money, because the basic problem here is that each country has its own legal system and they're not coordinated at all. Mm-hmm. So what the convention does is take that private contract and turn it into a new kind of what they call an instrument. It's sort of a super contract, and it gets privileged treatment for enforcement under this new international legal framework that's set up in the convention. So it makes it, the whole idea is to make it simpler to get your agreement enforced once you've reached this settlement. And the idea behind that is that mediation is a good thing and that we want to encourage it across borders. And so if it's easier to enforce the agreement, it should encourage companies and people to use mediation. That's the ultimate goal here.
And is enforcement the number one concern of parties that are doing cross-border mediations? Are there other challenges facing people doing cross-border mediations that might surprise listeners who don't practice in this area?
Well, I think there's always challenges, just basic language difficulties and different legal systems. But in terms of what happens once you reach an agreement in mediation, enforcement is the biggest problem, at least in the U.S. James Coben, who's up at Mitchell Hamlin Law School in St. Paul, has done a fabulous study looking at enforcement in the U.S. And he found that by far the biggest issue about mediation in general is enforcement. Mm. And he looked at the number of the cases that are filed in court and found that about half of them are cases to do with enforcement. So it's gone down a little bit over the years, but it's still almost 40% of all litigation about mediation is enforcement. And when you put that in the international context, the perception is that it's much harder to get enforcement.
What kind of issues would people run into in enforcement of these foreign mediations?
Well, in addition to just the contract problem and the different contract laws in different countries, some countries have what from our perspective would be weird requirements. So for example, some of the European countries require your settlement agreement to be officially approved by a notary. And notaries have a different function there, more judicial function than our notaries, which we just use for signatures. And so you might not know that. If you were a company in Columbus buying something from a company in, say, Germany, and you had a dispute and you made a settlement, you thought you were done. But if it weren't endorsed by a notary, you might not be able to get it enforced. So that's the kind of local requirement that the convention is designed to avoid. Another problem is that in some countries, you need to turn your mediated settlement into an arbitral award in order to get it enforced. That means hiring an arbitrator and getting the arbitrator to issue an award. So that's expensive and that's time. And that seems completely unnecessary when you have reached an agreement. Who needs an arbitrator to now turn it into an award? So these are all some very practical problems. There's also a philosophical problem, I think. Some people have found it hard to convince their business partners to use mediation because it doesn't carry the same legitimacy internationally that arbitration does. With arbitration, probably a lot of our listeners who are familiar with that know that we have what's called the New York Convention, and that enables much easier enforcement of awards than if you had a court decision.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. I just had Professor Vera Korzun and Professor Ben Davis on the podcast about the New York Convention and how it can increase confidence in foreign arbitration. So the Singapore Convention is mediation focused instead of arbitration focused, but does the new Singapore Convention have some those same aims of the New York Convention?
Very much so. I think people felt that the New York Convention has, well, it was originally negotiated in the 50s, but that it has been really important in making international arbitration what it is today. And the hope is that the Singapore Convention can do the same for mediation by giving it the recognition that the Arbitration Convention has. And sort of legitimize mediation as an accepted form of reaching solutions to disputes worldwide.
And take down some of those roadblocks for uncertainty and cost of enforcing, like you were talking about, of enforcing some kind of breach of a mediated settlement agreement.
Yes, and in fact, the negotiators really took inspiration from the New York Convention. The structure of the Singapore Convention is based on the pro-enforcement approach of the New York Convention for Arbitral Awards. And so let me explain what I mean by that. If two countries are members, have ratified the Singapore Convention, that means that those nations the language is shall enforce settlement agreements that fall under the convention. So not family and not employment and not consumer, but commercial international agreements. And so let's say that the U.S. decides to ratify it and Singapore's ratified it. If we have companies in those two countries who reach a settlement of their commercial dispute, then either country's courts are required by the treaty to enforce that agreement. There are some grounds that are listed in the convention that can be defenses. So if one party does, the party that's resisting enforcement can prove particular defenses, that will lead to no enforcement. But the starting point is that the country's courts shall enforce unless the party can prove various defenses. And some of those are contract defenses. If there was incapacity or the agreement has been modified or performed or is null and void, various things like that. If the mediator breached standards, if it's contrary to public policy, you can argue in court against enforcement. But the basic starting point is that the courts shall enforce. So that's what, and that's the way the arbitration convention works as well. It's very pro-enforcement.
Well, thank you for that deeper dive.
Sorry.
No, it's good. I just used the words deeper dive because of your marine biology background. That's the metaphor I thought would stick here. So thanks for letting us know what the nations who are parties have to do. And is there flexibility to the application of the convention to foreign mediations? Do they have flexibility after you sign on?
Yes. Countries can sign on with what are termed in international law reservations. So they can limit the application of the Singapore Convention. One reservation might be that they're not going to use it for any kind of disagreement with the government, so that the convention wouldn't apply then. And then the other flexibility involves opting in and opting out of the convention. The way it's structured now, unless your country makes a reservation, you are bound by the convention unless you affirmatively opt out. And that structure is designed to make the convention be as far-reaching as possible. In other words, you have to take action to avoid the convention if your countries have ratified it. But it's possible for a country to decide they want to make it the reverse. that they will only apply it if parties opt in to the coverage. So there's flexibility on the part of the country with how they structure it, and there's flexibility with the parties. If they do not want this enforcement scheme, they do not have to accept it. But you asked earlier about your sweater ordered from China.
Yeah.
this kind of complexity is part of the reason why we wouldn't impose this on your consumer transaction, because of the complexities of needing to opt in or opt out of the convention. And hopefully you got your sweater.
Still waiting. I still have hope, though. We'll see. You've identified a few provisions of the convention that you see could be controversial. Can you walk us through those?
Yeah, so particularly mediators in the U.S. have identified some of these elements as problematic. There's always disagreements. One is what I just described, the idea that the standard is you have to decide you don't want to be covered rather than affirmatively agreeing to be subject to the convention. Some people feel that that might surprise, say, a small company who doesn't have a sophisticated lawyer with a lot of international experience might feel trapped by that. On the other hand, being subject to the convention is supposed to be a good thing, so that should be okay. Another aspect that I think some mediators are objecting to is that this is not supposed to cover negotiated agreements. It's only for mediated agreements. Mm. And so how do you make that distinction? The convention requires a proof that it's mediation. Mm. And so that can be controversial. One is you're supposed to have evidence that it was mediation. Well, that could be the mediator signs the agreement. Mediators in the U.S. don't usually do that. They're not bound by the agreement.
And you don't usually record your mediations. I mean,
no, you do not. I mean, you tend to have a written agreement, mm-hmm. but it's signed by the parties, not by the mediator. Another thing that could happen would be the mediator could fill out a separate form that says, I mediated this, and this is a result of mediation. Or if you had an institution, say the American Arbitration Association was administering the mediation, they could sign something that says this was mediation. But these are steps that we don't usually take in the U.S., and so some mediators are objecting to that.
Might be an extra consideration if you are going to do these international mediations. How do we get this proof, you know, like as a consideration if you're going to start doing those to determine what
that's right. And another question is why aren't negotiations going to be enforced in this manner? What does the mediator add that makes mediation distinct? And part of that decision to draw a line between mediation and negotiation is that this is a big step for many countries. And so they wanted to encourage people to ratify it, and let's just take one step and have it for mediation. Another controversial aspect is that one of the defenses to having the settlement agreement enforced is that your mediator breached standards. And mediators don't like to think that they're not doing the right thing. I'm not saying this very eloquently, but I think that the standards in the convention set a very high bar for this. It has to be a serious breach of mediator standards. It has to be a breach that, if it were not for the breach, the parties would not have entered into the agreement. So it has to be crucial to the decision to abide by the agreement. With arbitrators, we worry about this because arbitrators are making a decision. With mediators, it's the party's agreement. So even if the mediator, let's say, fails to disclose a relationship with one of the parties, which would be inappropriate, you could still say that the parties decided, aside from that, that this agreement is in their best interest. Mm-hmm. So this would be very, very hard to prove. So it has to have a material effect on the outcome. But it's something that's, you know, once you get into enforcement and you get into grounds to not enforce, it can bring the mediator under the lens, and that's controversial. That's
controversial. They don't want to be under cross-examination. No.
That's right. And mediators, we assume, don't have that kind of effect on the outcome. So that's, the other point I would like to make is that when we're talking about mediation here, I said mediation, not negotiation, but mediation is very much a term of art in this convention. We tend to use the term mediation in the US, and it's growing in usage around the world. But a lot of countries use what they call conciliation. And the definition of mediation is very broad. So it could include something like early neutral evaluation, if our listeners might be familiar with a court program that does that, and ombuds. The label doesn't matter at all. You can call it, Zingo, and as long as it fits in with the process as defined in the convention, that's okay. And so it's where the parties are trying to reach an amicable settlement of their dispute, and they have the assistance of a third person, a third party. And that third party, unlike arbitration, does not have the authority to impose a solution. In other words, the key is it's up to the parties. So the label doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a court program. It doesn't matter if it's private. It doesn't matter if it's voluntary or if the court sends someone to mediation. None of that matters. It's just amicable solution, third person helping you, third party helping you, and the third party can't make the decision. So from my perspective, as a professor in dispute resolution, that's problematic because we're trying to educate people about the difference between mediation and early neutral evaluation and the different kinds of mediation. And what the convention does is lump it all together. So why did they do it? Because, again, you want the broadest coverage possible, and not getting hung up on the terminology of what things are called in specific countries.
Okay, let's talk about specifically the United States. The United States has signed on to this convention, right?
We have signed, we have not ratified.
Okay.
And there's a long list of conventions waiting for the Senate to take action on them, but they do tend to act much more quickly on these commercial convention. So we hope there will be a ratification from the U.S.
Should be good for business. So yeah.
That's right. That's the whole point of it.
So how do you see the convention impacting the U.S.?
Well, I think that it will encourage mediation in cross-border disputes. And so hopefully that will save money and time for parties with disputes. Hopefully it will allow them to reach solutions that are more tailored for their situation rather than something that the arbitrator thinks should be the outcome. Well, and another thing that might happen in addition to the primary goal, encouraging cross-border mediation, it might make people more interested in having some new legislation here in the US. Right now, there's nothing at all on enforcing mediated agreements. We have in Ohio the Uniform Mediation Act, and it's primarily about confidentiality. When that was drafted, they were very interested in trying to find something about enforcement, but they couldn't agree on anything. And it's possible that if this works well in the international sphere, that they might try again in the US for that. And perhaps they could follow the example of the international and limit it to commercial disputes, because some of the biggest problems come in when you are trying to include consumer transactions and employment transactions. So that might be something that will happen in the US that could eventually affect Ohio as well.
and all domestic mediations too, just a roll down impact onto that.
The big goal is to try and encourage people in the U.S. to use mediation when they're dealing with international transactions. The other effect in Ohio, right now, our law, if the convention is ratified in the U.S., the Ohio law would be inconsistent, because what it does is automatically turn the kind of agreements that are subject to the convention into arbitration awards and treat them like that, put them under the New York Convention. And that would be unnecessary and contradictory if there's a new legal regime. So we'll see what happens. But I think the main effect in Ohio and elsewhere will be that companies, when they're planning their transactions, have another tool in their toolkit, in their toolbox to use mediation, as people have come to see arbitration as often being really expensive and time consuming and much more like litigation.
That's so interesting. So it might just open a lot of doors to these international companies wanting to do mediation instead of litigation, instead of arbitration. One more thing to try, one more way of settling our disputes.
And if they try it and it works, maybe they'll like it. Who knows?
That's right. So I want to spend another minute talking about what you were saying at the beginning about you being there for this new Singapore convention, to be on the scene when deliberations were happening in New York. So can you talk more about that? It just sounds like such an interesting experience. How did you get to do that?
Well, they were looking for observers from the American Society of International Law, and I applied and said that I would write about this topic, and I was lucky enough to be selected for two different negotiations. The room that you usually see on the news is the room for the General Assembly. That's like a giant semicircle, half a circle. This room wasn't as wide, but it was gigantic, and it's just so impressive. There were doors for entrances on two different floors. And the thing that's most unusual is to see the simultaneous translation. So there are these amazing people up in glass boxes on either side, and every seat has a little earphone that you put in and you dial what language you would like to hear things in. Now, sometimes the translators get a little bit behind, or you can tell that things are a bit garbled, but it was really an amazing process. And of course, English speakers are lucky, because many, many of the delegates were speaking in English. Some, I think for political reasons, were not. So the Russians, they speak English very, very well. But in this formal public setting, of course, they're going to speak in Russian, and it gets translated. And there were a few other countries. The French tend to speak in French, the language of diplomacy.
Exactly, yeah.
The other thing that was really amazing was the process. There's a chairperson, and she calls on people in the order. You press a button if you want to speak, and a light comes on, and she will call on you, and you make what's termed an intervention, which is a comment. And she then manages to sort of pull these comments together and say, well, it appears we have consensus on this point, but we have different viewpoints on this point. And she keeps it rolling and she keeps it moving along. And a lot of the work was done in breaks. So they would have consultation breaks, and then the delegates could speak to each other and work things out informally. It was just a fascinating process to watch, because people were coming with very different viewpoints. There were some who did not think a convention should be negotiated at all. They wanted a model law for countries and not a binding international treaty. And what we ended up with was a dual. So there's a model law and there's the convention, in order to keep everyone on board and as happy as possible. It was fascinating from both the physical point of view and seeing the process.
So do you have any advice to give to anybody who would have opportunity to participate in an international cooperative effort like this?
I would say jump on it. If you're lucky enough to get, you had to get BCOGET credentialed. You had to apply ahead of time. There was quite a process of, in the morning, of rushing in and getting your badge. And it was a lot of fun. I would say more than something like these negotiations, I would urge anyone who has an opportunity to do anything international at all to jump on it. And for me, the year living in the Netherlands was amazing, and it just opens your mind and your eyes to things that not everyone lives the same way we do, and not everyone does everything the same way. Banking's a little different, transportation's different. You just get used to the idea that things don't have to be the way we're used to them. And I think that, as well as just meeting fascinating people from all around the world.
They do say travel's the best education. So
that's right. Yeah. Travel is wonderful, but if you have a chance to actually live someplace,
even better. Yeah,
that's even better, because you have to cope with the banking, and it was confusing. And you know, this is an advanced Northern European Western country, but the banking was different than the way we do it in the U.S. So.
Well, we're reaching the end of our time at this podcast today, and there's a bit I like to do at the end, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. So there'll be two questions for you, the presenter, and one question that you will have for the listener, for our audience today, as a kind of pop quiz to see if they've been paying attention. So question one's for you. What is an interesting and relatively brief mediation or arbitration related story you can share?
Well, I guess I could go back to the Iran United States Claims Tribunal and share a story of sitting in on the deliberations. The arbitrators, there's three arbitrators around a table, and their legal assistants got to sit there with them. We had a German arbitrator as the third member of the panel. So one U.S. arbitrator, one Iranian arbitrator, and one German. And it was fascinating to watch and see him really be the decider, because usually the Iranian took the Iranian side and the American took the American side. Not always, but almost always.
All right. Question two then. Who is an amazing person you know related to the field of mediation, and why do you appreciate them?
Oh, there's so many to choose from. I think I'm going to say my students, because I think it's not a specific person, but they're the future of mediation and of dispute resolution in general. And they're so interested in it, and they come at it with an open mind and an enthusiasm. And I think that Ohio's a wonderful place to teach this subject, because the court system has embraced mediation, and there really are opportunities for mediators. So I guess I would say I'm going to not quite answer your question, but say I really appreciate the situation in Ohio and having such wonderful students.
Yeah, now you have to give the audience a knowledge check. What's a question that they should be able to answer after listening to this podcast?
Oh, I'm gonna make this real easy, because...
kind of you.
So if you heard someone talking about the United Nations Convention on International Settlement Agreements resulting from mediation, what would you think? What word should come into your mind?
Very good. I think I could answer it. Well, do you have any, we're about at the end. Do you have any closing, anything else you wanted to add to your topic before we sign off today?
No, I'd just like to thank you for this opportunity and the listeners that have stuck with us this long. And I hope that they've learned something, and that this convention is part of the future of mediation in the United States and in Ohio.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Ellen Deason, for talking with us today about the new Singapore Convention. And also to you, our listeners, for tuning in today. Thank you for everyone out there working for justice. Stay healthy.